Welcome to The Drummer's Pathway, the podcast about music, life, and the creative process. Hello, I'm Michael Scott, and welcome to The Drummer's Pathway podcast. This episode features my conversation with drummer David Abruzzese. Growing up in Texas, David discovered his passion for music early on and began to develop his skills as a drummer through his work with many local bands. In 1991, through a recommendation from drummer Matt Chamberlain, David went to Seattle to audition for Pearl Jam, who were just getting ready to release their debut album. He became a member of the band and held that position from 1991 to 1994, during which time he recorded the iconic albums Verses and Vitology. After working with Pearl Jam, David continued to establish himself as a freelance drummer and has gone on to work with multiple artists, showcasing his creative and versatile approach to the drums. In our conversation, we talk about his early inspirations and how his passion for music helped to develop his creative approach. We discuss the process of recording the Verses and Vitology albums and what it was like working with renowned producer Brendan O'Brien. We also talk about what he's been up to since Pearl Jam and why it's essential to appreciate all the opportunities that are presented to you. And now, my conversation with David Abruzzese. You were originally raised in Texas.
Yeah.
And through that time, I'm kind of interested in terms of what was your inspiration to become a drummer during the time growing up in that city?
Well, you know, in Texas, I always say I was raised in Texas because I made most of my mistakes there, the ones that counted, and I was able to learn from and take those lessons into my, you know, young adult life. But I was born in Connecticut, and then went from Connecticut to North Carolina for nearly 2 years. And then North Carolina, the family moved to Texas. And I don't know where the inspiration came from to play drums. I mean, my dad had a late 60s Barracuda, and it had the single speaker in the back deck behind the seats. And I, you know, it was back when you're a kid to be a kid. And I would, survival of the fittest, I would climb up there. Instead of sitting on the transmission hump, I would climb up and lay on that speaker, and FM radio was playing, you know, the Beatles and Simon and Garfunkel. And then the singer songwriter era happened. And then my older brother turned me on to albums. Mm-hmm. I had a record player, and my dad turned me on to Grand Funk, and there was Kiss and Zeppelin and FM radio when I was in fifth, sixth, seventh grade, you know, it was Aerosmith and Foghat and just, I mean, the music, you know, it carried you somewhere. And yeah, I know that anyone under 25, 30 can't relate to that, you know, because yeah. Now you have so many avenues to go into fantasy with technology. But back then, I mean, you weren't even impatient waiting for the next month's issue of your rock and roll magazine to lay out the fantasy that was, you know, your heroes on the stage. And it just, you know, I liked sports. At that era of idealistic looking up to something, it was just rock and roll, you know? And, it's just amazing. I got lucky to be surrounded by people that had great soundtracks to their lives, you know? And then when I started going to shows, it was AC/DC and Triumph and, you know, and just bands that were so incredibly, you know, powerful live that, I just had to do it. But I don't know what, you know, no one in the family played music. My mom would, you know, sing in the kitchen and stuff like that. But I don't know what made me feel like expressing myself by hitting things with wood. I have no idea.
Well, and a lot of the people that I talk to, they go through their process of development as an artist and they say, okay, I started out first getting the bug and then I would go through and I would start formal lessons. And then you go through this process. You're someone that's coming from a situation where your education was music and your education was rock and roll, yeah. Putting yourself into those mm-hmm. scenarios. And that's how you developed who you are as a player. And it's really obvious to me when I listen to the things that you have done that you're coming from a vast series of different musical influences. You know, when you listen to some people, you go, okay, they were raised in this particular genre and those are their influences. Right. And that's something that became a huge part of them. But I think people would be very surprised considering you're most well known for your time with Pearl Jam and the grunge era, but there's a lot of other influences in there that have really made you who you are. And so I find it really interesting, you know, getting into the singer-songwriter aspect of things and really just kind of a whole melting pot of influences.
You know, I think being self-taught and, you know, my relationship with the music was internal. And my understanding of how things worked and how they related to each other, it was the songs. It wasn't necessarily the styles. And I think that helped my development as a player because, you know, it's still to this day, I play for the song and there's some process in my head that relates the music to what my role in it's going to be. And I, you know, it's like, sometimes I can explain it, but the process of like, you know, in a session when I sit down and I just have the music, the relationship that forms between the arrangement of my part and how, and what I'm cueing off of and what I'm trying to support and all that stuff, it's still like an unspoken process in my head that I understand, you know, because my biggest thought is what's the point of what I'm doing, you know?
Yes.
It's like, whether it's fills or a beat or how busy or it's just like, what, you know, why do that instead of this? And that can, you know, that question and answer fires so quickly in sessions. It's a part of my playing. The answers are based off of definitely the influences of all those different listening experiences, and visualizing is how I learned how to play. You know, listening to the music, I could picture the parts being played. And it was amazing when I did get behind the drum set when I was little. Actually, the first one, I hammered encyclopedias to a bookshelf. Well, that really pissed my parents off. and then hid it in my closet. And I would go in there and I had a snare drum. And I kicked the case for my bass drum. And then I had the thin to thick encyclopedias for the toms. But as far as the coordination aspect, you know, somehow from 4 years old to 8 or 9, I had got coordinated and developed control just from imagining I was playing the drums every time I heard music. And it's funny because I was playing at this thing, Mike Dillon, great percussionist. He had this like jam. He took over a club and there were probably 25 drum sets, 20 drummers only. And Michael Shreve was there, Santana's drummer from long ago, but Michael's done so many other things. But Michael came up to me at one point and said, "Wow, I didn't know you were schooled." And I was like, that was an amazing call. I said, "No, I'm not." And he was taken aback. He was like surprised because of all the styles that we were playing. And it's funny because, you know, it's like when I would sit in with a reggae band, I just play what I thought should be played. And it was still my style, but it was reggae. You know, if I was playing funk, it was still the way I related to it. But, you know, I was a funk drummer. And when I played metal and had two bass drums, I was a metal drummer. You know, it was just, but I never thought of myself as any of those things.
Yeah, as I said, you're best known for your time in Pearl Jam and the grunge era, but it's really obvious to me that you have a background playing groove and funk music in different sort of styles, because all of those elements are things that got incorporated into the things that you did when you played with them. And I think that's one of the things that really made your drumming during that era really stand out and sort of capture my attention, because of those groove elements and because of the elegance of the subtleties that you would incorporate into the bombastic sort of straight ahead, balls to the walls kind of rock aspect. There was the real morphing of those two different styles, and I think that's something that really captured my attention.
It's interesting, you know, a lot of times, like I'll go into a session and someone will say, you know, do some of those Dave Abruzzese things. And it's like, you know, it's funny because the style I played, like on Verses and Vitalogy and on every song, there's different feels, of course. But, you know, to me in that group, the way we wrote and the way we recorded, I felt like I was having... You know, I was like a catcher on the baseball team. I had to, you know, introduce movements, introduce parts, give hints that we were about to do something, all those different things to keep the train on the tracks, you know? And also I had such an intricate relationship with Stone Gossard's rhythm playing. And you know, when he and I would always, you know, be there early for rehearsals and when we were writing, and he would be playing a riff and the way he moved his head would tell me, you know, if I started playing and his head started going a different direction, I knew that wasn't it. Mm-hmm. And so I would switch until I got him back to the motion he was making before I joined in. And so I got to give props to Mike Dillon, who's just an incredibly strong influence on me, as to what percussion can do to propel music forward, and Matt Chamberlain, because they were the duo when I was, you know, watching in the club window and Ten Hands was playing. They just did this. They just had this thing that made the music move in such a really unique and cool way. But it's still your body movements were never, you never hiccuped. You never, you know, got stopped in your tracks. But to me, it was, you know, the aspect of it kept the music interesting and the energy, you know, controlled, but there was a tension to it, like tension, like, you know, and to, you know, I felt like the 10 record didn't have any real tension, except for there were some tempo, you know, things. But I really paid attention to like driving the hat and pulling the kick back and things like, you know, but they were just decisions I made on the fly because, you know, the songs, I just wanted them to be powerful, you know? I wanted them to be powerful, whether, you know, I didn't know what the album was going to sound like. So, and what I heard in my headphones was just crap. So I was just trying to make sure the parts were there.
Well, and interestingly enough, you were not on the first Pearl Jam album 10. You joined the band, I think, just before the album came out.
Just before.
And so people look back at that time and they think this is this iconic album that became this worldwide sensation. And then you joined in after that. But they don't always realize that it was not what it became at that particular time. And one of the things that I've heard you say in other conversations that I actually appreciate is that when you were given the option or the chance to audition to be in Pearl Jam, which came through Matt Chamberlain.
Right.
You had sort of looked, you know, you hadn't even listened to the 10 album at that point. I think you'd heard a couple of snippets of things. And you had sort of said, if I have to play everything exactly like it is on the record, I'm really not interested in going this way because I want to join a situation where I can be my own creative self and feel like I have input, not in essence, just become in and play the role of a session player.
Yeah, and looking back, and adjusting, you know, what I was going through in an adult manner, I would agree with exactly what you said. At the time, I was in a position where, you know, I was 23. I'd been playing a long time, and I was in a group with guys that I loved, and that I didn't see any better situation to be in. Mm-hmm. And yet, we were going as far as we could. You know, we didn't have a lawyer in any of our families, and our parents weren't in the industry, and, you know, we didn't have an in. And you know, and I played just as hard as I ever did. And so, you know, it was one of the things. I was on the way home from the gig that Matt Chamberlain and Mike Dillon saw me playing at when Matt was talking to Mike about, you know, this G.E. Smith gig, and he didn't want to leave Pearl Jam hanging. And Mike said, well, what about Dave? You know, on the way home from that gig, I stopped at a stoplight abruptly, and my snare drum went skidding across the intersection, bounced out of the back of my little Ranchero. And I was like, oh, there goes, you know, I made $50 at the gig, and that's at least, you know, I can't get another snare drum for that. So,
yeah.
But when I got home, I was feeling like, how much more am I going to put into this? You know, the effort of, you know, I don't see how much farther I could go. And it was the first time I'd ever considered that in my, you know, life of playing. You know, the first time I didn't set my drums up when I got home from a gig, I stacked them up in the house. And the next day was when Matt called about the audition. But yeah, when I listened to the 10 record, I didn't make it through 20 seconds of any of the songs. And, you know, I had a cassette, and we actually listened to it on the radio show that I co-hosted with my friend Chris. And we play a little, and I was like, eh, and then Chris, it's hilarious, he said, and this was on air, well, have you ever been to Seattle? I said, no. He said, well, it's a free trip to Seattle. And the next day I called the management office, and Jeff and Eddie just happened to be there, and they got on the phone, and I asked them, you know, do you guys want me to learn this record, you know, these songs as they are? And if they would have said yes, then I was going to say, then I don't want to waste your money or your time, you know, because it really didn't, but they didn't. They said, no, just come up and we'll jam and we'll just see how it goes. And, you know, it's like, I wasn't really expecting that, you know, and it was the perfect, any other answer then, and I wouldn't have went, but then for them to say, just come up and we'll just play some music and see how it feels. And it's like, oh, excellent. So, yeah, it was quite some time that, I mean, I never really, well over a year, maybe two, that I'd never heard a Pearl Jam song all the way through off the 10 record, you know, not the album version. And I remember I was in a pool hall, and I heard one of the songs, and I was like, oh, that's what he's saying. This was like 2 years into it. I was like, I never even understood that release was like a conversation that he was having with his father. I had no idea. It's like a weird thing, but it just wasn't my, you know, I appreciated the way it sounded and all that stuff, but it never resonated with me, you know. But performing it and being on stage and the energy of, I mean, the crowds were insane, and my playing style fit really well with the upped level. I mean, we played that record with, you know, it definitely wasn't, they weren't the same songs that were on that record when we were touring them. You know, they were much more like hard. They were rock. They were energy. Yeah. They were aggressive, you know.
Yeah, there was a much more dynamic edge to them, and a jam element that allowed them to kind of turn into what they eventually became. And I think that's one of the things that I really appreciated about the live aspect of the band wasn't that you were just going up and just playing the songs. There was still an element of, we're not quite sure where this is going to go.
Yeah.
That's the fun of the experience.
The cool thing too was we would just go. We would just go off, and very quickly, I don't know how the other guys felt. I assume it was the same, and that's why it worked. But there was, you know, to go off into a freeform jazz odyssey in front of 60,000 people, and have no, I never once worried about how it was going to end up. I never once, you know, it was like it, when we played live, when we would go off into a jam, I mean, you know, I could, Eddie could start singing and I would start playing, and I knew it wouldn't be a train wreck. You know, I could start playing, and if somebody else started playing, I knew it wouldn't be a train wreck. And, you know, that part of that band, of that version of that band, I mean, that's the same way we approached creating music and writing songs too, was just, it was, I never once felt like any anxiety or nervousness about whether what we were going to do was going to be a quality thing. You know, I had such confidence. That was the biggest thing that I felt, you know, that was like the thing that hurt me on the inside, because to me that was, you know, people have always asked like about, yeah, you know, it's like that degree of badassness isn't easy to I've played with a lot of really incredible people, but to have that kind of confidence in your element, five people working together as a unit, that just doesn't happen easily and often, especially with the, you know, it, playing to me is so physically demanding and emotionally demanding that I couldn't, after Pearl Jam, I couldn't settle for that being any different, you know. It was crazy. It was just crazy because, I mean, I knew it didn't happen easily, but I was amazed on both sides. There were times where I worked with people and I was so shocked at how natural our creative work was. Like Roger Hodgson from Supertramp, when we worked together, astonishing. Just, I mean, I didn't recognize my own playing when we worked together. He inspired me to go in so many directions, but the inspiration came from the feelings that were coming out of what we were creating together in real time. You know, it was unspoken, and that to me, that's magic. And Pearl Jam, you know, had this very tangible, magical aspect to it, you know, but I still, you know, we never spoke about it. And I still wonder if the other guys in the band ever even understood it, you know, or, you know, I don't know.
The first album you did with Pearl Jam, which is still one of my favorite albums of that generation, was the album Versus, which was Pearl Jam's follow-up to their 10 album. And it was produced by Brendan O'Brien, who was an established up-and-coming producer at the time, who not only was just a producer, but also an exceptional engineer. And so one of the things...
And musician, yeah.
Yeah. One of the things I find really interesting about that record is that it's a sonically outstanding recording. When you listen to a lot of albums of that time, everything kind of has the same sonics to them, the same drum sound, the same thing. And the album collectively is a great artistic piece. But the thing I love about Versus is that every track has its own personality. Every track has its own dynamic. And it is incredibly inspiring, the different directions that went into. So I'm really curious, in particular for you, what was the experience like recording that record? I know a lot of it came together in jam aspects in the studio. It wasn't a situation where you walked in, all the songs were done, you recorded them. It was created in that environment. So can we talk a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. We had basically just made the decision that for the couple of months that we were going into our rehearsal room and coming up with ideas for songs. That's kind of how we were approaching it. We had a good amount of song ideas, and some of them were very close to finished and some of them were solid, but we didn't, you know, it's like, that's a good idea. It's worth taking with us into the studio. But we did that on purpose. We didn't, when we left the rehearsal room and went to the studio, I was recording all the rehearsals and going home and listening and really putting a lot of effort into the arrangements and, you know, trying to, I felt like it was really important to stay away from the boom, da-bat, boom, boom, da-bat feel that a lot of Pearl Jam music, like that Stones kind of his feel. And at that point, you know, Eddie was doing a lot of, you know, like melody, like scatting, you know, melodies. And so there was an emotional element, but there was definitely a melodic element. And so I was trying to create my parts, paying a lot more attention to the melodic aspects of drumming, so that each song could be a song rather than, you know, I didn't want there to be any a sense of fillers, like, you know, like that sort of thing. And then when we got into the studio, and when we were writing, you know, I had just this small little setup. And when I was listening to these tracks at home, you know, I was hearing that, yeah, I would definitely want this song, you know, it bigger, you know, cymbal sounds or deeper snare, or, you know, I was thinking of those aspects of the songs in my arrangements. And when we got down to the studio, the biggest thing about that record and the Vitalogy as well, every song, you know, when I got up in the morning and I knew we were going to work on Go, for instance, I knew I wanted a snare drum sound that was, you know, just crazy aggressive. So I got that 13-inch by 3 Black Beauty and, you know, and just cranked the shit out of it. And, you know, I was like changing my tunings on the kit. And the way Brendan worked is real, you know, he documented the real sounds of what was going on. You know, it wasn't like there were a lot of samples and shit like that. So, you know, we had my old Ludwig kit that we were putting in a tile room, and you know, it was just basically every song I was approaching the drum parts and the arrangements and the timbre, the sound of the drums for the songs, you know? And it was really cool, because I think Versus is a record where it's Eddie's voice and Stone and Mike's guitar sounds that define the continuity of the album sonically. But the bass sounds and the drum sounds really, you know, take each song and put it in its own place, you know? And that, you know, Brendan, he worked really fast, and it was a lesson in, you know, if you have a good player on a good instrument with a good mic and a good console, my job's done, you know? And the discipline of his engineering skill is that he knows what, you know, all that needs to be done is proper documenting of a proper performance, you know? And it was incredible, because we could start in the morning, and by dinner time, the song was finished, sonically finished. You know, the rough mixes sounded very much like the mixes on the record, because Brendan was putting those sounds to tape that he wanted, you know? It wasn't like, Vitalogy was totally different. You know, the sounds that I heard of those songs versus what came out on the record were night and day different, but that was a different time.
I had read somewhere that, as you said, that Brendan, he basically, we'd record the song and then he would mix the song and then the song was done and then he would go on and do the next one. So every song was created like a separate piece. And then the Versus album is basically a collection of artistic pieces that are put together in an order that make a statement. Whereas traditionally, a whole album is recorded, and then once everything is done, they look back at it and then they try and make sense to the pieces that are put together. So, I think sometimes what happens is that when you do that, you lose the magic and the enthusiasm of what made the track in the first place. And so I think that's one of the reasons why that album sonically just sounds so incredible to me.
And you know, the thing too, couple that with the fact that there was magic and enthusiasm with the staff at the studio, with us, with the crew, with Brendan. I mean, everybody was there supporting the same cause. There wasn't any prima donna shit. There wasn't any strife. There wasn't, you know, and it lent itself to us being five individuals putting forth our best work at that time for those songs at that time. You know, when I was working with people producing records, and sometimes when I'm working with people tracking drums, I see that youth and that, you know, where it's like, oh, that sounds great. No, you sound great. The song as a whole is pretty weak. You know, it's like there's a Pearl Jam. You know, when we were making that record, if we were immature players and judging the songs on our own sound and our own abilities, it was okay because everyone else, I don't know if that happened, but I think the reason I don't know is because we were all so proud of what we as a whole were doing. You know, I remember driving home with a cassette of what was to be our record, and I couldn't stop listening to it, you know, and I wasn't just listening to, you know, how badass my drums sounded. I was listening, I was catching all these nuances and I was like really listening into, wow, Mike and Stone are playing so well together. And, oh, that works so well, you know, and it was just, yeah, it was exciting. It was really exciting. And we worked so fast and didn't have to, it was not torturous at all making that record.
Brendan is a producer. What was his approach to pull performances out of you?
Well, me personally, he was a master. But as the way he worked with us as a band, I don't think anybody else could have. He was perfect for us at that time. We all respected him so much, and he was just. He is a very genial fellow. He's a good guy. You know, he's likable. He's really smart, incredibly talented. One of the most gifted guitar players I've ever seen. And he really knows what he's doing. And his confidence allowed us to not have to worry about, you know, not have to doubt his ability. And he never, you know, he was real subtle with the way he would steer ideas. He, you know, it's like somebody was trying something. He would just suggest, you know, hey, you know, if that's not working, try something else. It was just that simple. And we were all open to that. But with me, you know, as far as the only suggestions that he put out playing wise, there were a few that stand out. You know, he would say, you know, maybe bash your way through that chorus a little more, like wash the right, you know, like open it up a little more and stuff like that. And that was part of the product of our writing in our little rehearsal room that just sounded terrible, is because in the parts I was playing, I didn't yet know how it was going to sound coming out of those speakers as a record, you know, and he was able to know that those guitar sounds, you know, if we want that to lift, you can really bash into it. And the other thing was, one night we were playing poker, as we did often, after dinner, and he made a comment. You know, it was like he was talking to someone over there, but he was looking in my direction. And he said, yeah, I've never really liked China cymbals or splashes in rock and roll. It's just blah, blah, blah. And so the next morning, we were starting tracking on Animal. And I went in a little early and I took out all my China cymbals from my cymbal case and set them all up, took down all my crashes and put just Chinas and splashes up. So that song is there's no crash symbols. It's just all Chinas, because he said he didn't like them. And so I was like, I'll show you. But, you know, again, I would bet that he knew exactly what he was doing. You know, he wanted that energy from me. And so he got it from me. The rearview mirror, the feel of the song, we started working and, you know, I was having a lot of you know, pretty severe, like traumatic tendon injuries and stuff. So we started working on Rearview Mirror, and, you know, I knew it was going to be a beast. I knew that, you know, the next day, you know, I knew I was going to have a hard time sleeping that night. So we started playing and I just laid into it and played the song, but Brendan had the click track going in my head and really, really loud. And, after the song, boom, you know, it's really aggressive. And so I'm sitting there and my chest is heaving and I'm dripping sweat on the snare. And that click track is going pop, 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 pop in my head. And, you know, every other time, you know, the consideration of my ears and emotions, the click track turns off at the end, you know, but he kept it going. And I'm like yelling into the snare mic, turn the fucking click track off, you know, because it's like concussing. Because I taped the headphones to my head so they wouldn't fall off. And so he says, oh, yeah, just a second, Dave, on the talk back. And the click is still going, you know. And I'm just like losing my mind. And then he says, you know what? Let's do it. Let's do it again. Dave, if you could just give me a little more. I'm like, give you a little more of what? Like, what do you mean? You know, I'm still being civil at this point, and the click track, he's turned it off. He's like, I just give me a little more. I'm like, you want me to open it up? Let's just do it again. So the click track starts pow, pow, pow. And I start to count it off, and he says, just a second. Click track's still pounding. And I'm starting to get kind of pissed, you know, because I'm sitting here going, what the fuck does he want from me? You know, I wish he'd be, because I can't, you know, it hurts, you know.
Yeah.
So we played the song the second time, and I'm like, boom, the last note, click track's going, and I'm like waiting for him to say, okay, come on in, you know, come listen. And nothing. I just got that click track still pounding in my headphones, and I'm fuming at this point. I mean, I'm holding my sticks like, okay. And he said, and I said, so how was that? And he waits about 30 seconds. He goes, just a second. Oh, I'm losing my mind at this point. I'm losing my mind because I can't get up and go say what the fuck or anything. So I'm sitting there and the click track's still pounding. And then he does it again. Dave, I just need a little more from you. Now I'm starting, you know, it's like my hands are numb. I'm fuming, literally pissed. And so I played it. And, you know, it's still to the click track, but it's such the take that's on that record. Everything that I had to give, I was very angry. You know, I was full. It was just, I just hammered my kid. And at the end of the song, I punched the hole through my snare and threw my sticks and then went and threw my snare drum off the hill behind the pool, jumped in my car and left. That's my rock star tanty. Oh, geez. It's embarrassing to talk about now, but it's a shining example of a great producer getting what the track needs. Because I played exactly the same thing I did on the other two. The difference was where it came from.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
And it shows on the track. So it was outstanding. And he, far and away, I've been blessed to work with some really incredible engineers and producers and engineers that produce and mix guys. And yeah, Brendan, there was an incredible amount of learning that I had. You know, it's like anybody who works with him has the opportunity to really learn about the craft of engineering and making records, mixing albums, because he is just, his process is next level for sure. Just incredible.
When I look back at the Versus album, which to me sounds very much like an energetic collaboration of a bunch of people who are coming in from different perspectives, but all are on the same vision and same team. And that really comes across on that record. When I look at the follow-up, which is Vitology, to me, when I listen to that album, the comparison that I get to me, it sounds to me like Pearl Jam's White album, where you have a whole bunch of different visions that everyone has on their own, and the album is essentially put together with this person's songs and this person's songs, and this is the vision that I want to do, and it doesn't have the same collection or collaboration.
Yeah. I think the difference to me in my experience was Versus, we had everything to gain, nothing to lose.
Mm-hmm.
We went out and without saying a word to each other, we conquered the world together. You know, there were aspects that were tough, which, you know, like it seems really silly now, but there was a time where, you know, the crowds would chant Eddie, and that didn't bother me because watching him perform every night was a treat. I mean, the guys, you know, he put it all out there, as we all did. He inspired us. But by the time Vitology rolled around, we had everything to lose because there was nothing more to gain. You know, it's like the success that we got came because all of us put everything that we had into respecting this thing that we didn't understand, that just, you know, we'd walk off the stage and we'd all be soaking wet. And, you know, we'd look at each other like, okay, what are we going to do for an encore?
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't, you know, it was like, we knew that everything that we had to give, we all individually did. And you know, it was just, yeah, it was an amazing thing. But when we went in to do Vitalogy, there were these dynamics that were starting to happen that, yeah, it kind of messed with that. It started, the things that went unsaid before, they seemed to matter more now. You know, everyone was a little more pins and needles around, you know, do this or don't do this around, you know, Eddie's got to, like, I'd already went through the 3 weeks where he didn't speak to me because for whatever reason, you know? So it was like at that point, there was a dynamic shift. And a lot of that record was done while we were on the road. You know, we were going to various studios while we were on tour. You know, we'd schedule a week between shows and go into a studio and track two or three songs that we had written while we were on stage or at soundcheck or in the bus. So in that, it was different, but we were still, you know, if you look at Pearl Jam's catalog, I don't know if it's still that way, but when I was in the band, the verses in the Vitalogy record, they had all of our names as writers, you know, we were a band. That started shifting back again, you know, because that was a thing that we never put ourselves in the position where, if your name was under the song as a writer, you got paid more than somebody else. So we never, you know, we were all able to support each other creatively because it wasn't like the guitar player was driving a Vette and the drummer was still living in an apartment because the publishing splits were unfair because the drummer's not seen as a songwriter. When Stone asked me about, you know, Go, when we were filling out the copyright splits, I said, no, this, you know, everybody's song. You know, I just had an idea and the band turned it into a Pearl Jam song. And that maintained it. And so the Versus record, we were all, you know, we were a band credited with making an album. And so when we were making the Vitalogy record, the biggest difference, you know, Eddie picked up a guitar, which was something new, you know, but those songs were great. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't seen as a bad thing or anything, but there was definitely a lot more at that point, a lot more of, the dynamic had been set where no one said why or what or no way or fuck off. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like all of a sudden, you know, if Eddie made that face and walked off, you know, Stone would go and go the other way and Jeff would just be reading the paper and Mike would, you know, being Mike. It was like there was just this accepted way of things, you know, starting to go. And it just didn't, it was losing its connectivity.
And unfortunately, a very common story in, you know, the music business is the change from collaboration into corporation. So, and that's it's a very common story.
Yeah. Well, you know, you struggle together and you work as a unit because you're all you've got. You know, you lean on each other, you count on each other, and then success happens and all of a sudden you've got what you want. And the struggles become like, that's your problem, not mine. And that's where bands suffer. But that's where, you know, I mean, famously, bands that went through it, the Stones, you know, U2 made a record without even seeing each other in the same studio. They hated each other. You know, Kiss, all these bands that had such, you know, internal problems. The amazing thing was that management would tell them all to quit being petulant children and get their shit together and appreciate what they have, the opportunity to do what they, you know, what they signed up to do, be successful, you know? And, you know, I think with Pearl Jam, it was tough because, you know, we didn't have a manager that stood up for us. I mean, you know, as individuals. Kelly Curtis told me, oh, I think Stone wants to talk to you. Give him a call. That's how, and I called Stone and we met and I got fired. That's what my manager, that's how he, you know, as a, and I was hanging up the phone when he said, oh, hey, and by the way, get in touch with Stone. You know, he already knew that I was fired. So like that aspect, whereas, you know, like Doc McGee and like Aerosmith, man, you know, I mean, U2's manager tricked them all into getting the place together and locked the boarded the windows up. So deal with your shit, you know, and find a way to work together, because what you have is magic. You know, it just didn't work that way with our band at that point. I wish it had, you know, I wish it had.
After Pearl Jam, you went on to work with a number of different artists, and I'd really be interested in learning what some of those other collaborations and some of the names when I look at the list that come up that intrigue me are working with renowned guitar player Stevie Salas, renowned session vocalist Bernard Fowler, and bass player T.M. Stevens, who we unfortunately just recently lost.
Yeah.
Let's start with T.M. Stevens.
Well, I have to start actually with Stevie, because Stevie and Bernard came to the Indio Polo Field show, the infamous, you know, shoes getting thrown at a show. And Stevie had known, you know, the guys from Mother Love Bone days and all that stuff. And he has been Color Code. They were all coming up at the same time. And so he and Bernard, and, you know, Bernard was, had been with the Stones for quite a bit at that point. And Tackhead, of course, you know, game changing band. And I didn't know who they were. And I got introduced to him, and, you know, I just, you know, I just, you know, we talked for a few minutes or whatever. And then Stevie reached out and asked me if I would come down to his house after the, after, you know, Pearl Jam, after I'd been fired and all that. He reached out and said, hey, you know, I'm getting ready to do a record, and I want to see if you wanted to come down to, you know, he had a bomb shelter behind his place in LA in the hills. And he said, we'll just shed and see how it feels. I was like, wow, it's, you know, okay, cool. So I went down, and you know, Steve's an incredible, just an incredible guy. Energy, his skills are insane. His work ethic is incredible. But he has this way of you know, driving me batshit crazy. But he does it with this like childlike sense of, you know, he'll do something, and I'll go, what the fuck? And he'll go, hey, it's good for you, David. You know, it's like, and I just want to clobber him, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, you know, you're right. So, so we started, you know, we had this, it's almost like a big brother. He was like my big brother kind of a relationship where, you know, he'd call and I'd pick up the phone and say no. And then 15 minutes later, I'd be like, okay, I'll, you know, I'm booking a flight. So, but yeah, we were working, we did his alternative record, and we wrote and recorded an incredible amount, like, oh, you know, 10 plus songs in a handful of days, and Melvin Brandon on bass. And it was like back to my roots of like what I like to listen to and how I like to play with, you know, off the body movement. And the record, you know, it's still astonishing. You know, when I listened to it, it's like, there were songs that I, it's like, that's, I playing on that. I don't even remember, you know, it was like so fast. But he, you know, the circle that he was running in LA, it was fantastic, you know, and one day we were working on, another, might've been another album of his. And he said, you know, let's run over to, Dave Rouse's studio and Bernard Fowler's there. We're going to do a song with, Daryl Jones, you know, playing bass from, and I was like, you fucking kidding me? You know, Bernard and Daryl Jones. Yeah. And I actually had the flu, and it's like, let's go. So we went and recorded. It was, ended up on the Nickel Bag, Bernard and Stevie's record, the 12 hits and a bump. I think that song is The Bump, but it was really, you know, it was great. And Bernard and I hit it off, like, you know, from the moment we met. We were fast friends and family, and it's always been that way. And always connected. And we, you know, I would go down to LA, and it was always like, get off the plane, and there'd be a session somewhere. And it got to this place where we were all so busy that we never really got to hang out. So they put together this thing of, you know, doing this bop over Europe in the middle of winter and play songs and, you know, have some fun and hang out. And Jara Harris, you know, it, to me, one of the most well-rounded humans on the planet. His playing is inspired, and it's just him as a person. He's just a joy to spend time with. We did, you know, the International Motherfuckers shows over there, and TM, you know, is one of the motherfuckers. The band's made up of, you know, everybody, you know, all of the people that we know, and you know, and I was fortunate enough to do the tour with those guys a few times, and with TM, which was mind blowing because, you know, TM was in those magazines when I was a kid, you know, with Steve Vai. And when Pearl Jam first went to France, we were in Bastille Square, and I walked into my, you know, first time in France, and it was Bastille Day, and I opened my balcony in my hotel room, and I was looking down at Joe Cocker performing in Bastille Square on Bastille Day with T.M. Stevens on bass. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. That was a magical moment. And then, you know, Stevie had invited me to, he got a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Native American Music Awards. And Stevie and T.M. and I played as a three piece. We did that another time with Jean Bouvier and from Wendy Hill Williams and Tom from Cheap Trick and, Mickey Free playing too. And we, you know, it's amazing how many people that influenced me, you know, all hung out in the same group. And then all of a sudden I was part of that group. And TM, you know, it was one of the last things that maybe he might have done a couple of tours after the one that we did before he was stricken with dementia. And it was a trip because, you know, when we started, you know, we put in a few days of rehearsal before we went over to Europe to play. And you could kind of tell that something was off by the end of the tour. But, I mean, as I'm recalling things, I'm trying not to recall too much because I'll get emotional. But he was just as you'd hope. You know, so many of the people I looked up to, being a player that was inspired by the playing of people, you know, I didn't understand what they were doing mathematically. I was inspired by the image that were captured and the music that was behind the image. And so many of those guys, Stevie, Bernard, Ron Wood, Roger Hodgson, they were exactly as I needed them to be for me to, you know, it's so weird when you know, it's like before Zappa died, we got an invite to go up to his house and meet him. And I told everybody in the band that I didn't support that, that Frank Zappa's music was too important to me for an opportunity to be in a photo op with him. It's like my opinion of him as a person, I didn't want to meet the real Frank Zappa because I needed him to be the guy that I imagined he was.
Yes.
You know? Yeah, I couldn't risk that. But yeah, these guys, they actually, it's such an amazing, the amount of genuine, spirited, honest, incredibly giving and gifted people that play music. And then there's the value fuck, the people that have everything and are worth nothing, you know. But Stevie and TM and Bernard and Roger Hodgson and, I mean, it's incredible the amount of, you know, life of my life that has been blessed by not only the music of these incredible people, but you know, Eric Shankman. And I mean, the list is so long that I won't even try to make one. But yeah, I'm obnoxiously blessed with the opportunities I've had playing with Noel Redding and Billy Cox at Electric Ladyland, with Eddie Kramer at the console, with Eric Shankman on guitar. What the fuck? You know, it's like,
and know, that was part of the Jimi Hendrix tribute album, of which you played on a couple of tracks with.
Yeah, and I mean even the moments of, you know, it was supposed to be one song, and I was never, I mean, I don't feel ashamed to say I wasn't a Hendrix fan. I mean, I appreciate him, but it wasn't part of the soundtrack of my life. So getting invited by Eric was like, oh, of course. And then when Eric said that, you know, it's like, yeah, I'll do anything for you, Eric. And then when Eric said that, you know, Eddie's going to be producing it and engineering, it's like, well, the guy did fucking Zeppelin and Hendrix. Yeah. You kidding me? It's awesome. Then he said, and we're going to be playing with Noel Redding. It's like, holy shit. And so then I see Eddie the morning of the session at the hotel, and he says, you ready to knock these songs out? And I'm like, uh-oh, songs? More than one? And yeah, and so Jimmy and I scrambled to look for a bootleg cassette on the sidewalks so I could learn this other song, because not only did we track one with Noel Redding, but we had to have it done before Billy showed up, because those two guys would kill each other if they walked in the same studio, you know. So it was just like, it was those little moments of you know, the reality of the situation, just it makes it all that more awesome, you know.
Now, when you reflect back at this point to the things that you have accomplished throughout your musical career, and you look at where you are now as a creative artist, what are some of the biggest joys that you currently have in your life? And what are some of the biggest hurdles you are most proud of for overcoming?
Wow. That's a good question. You know, I don't know if I could come up with a, you know, I don't feel like I have regrets of any decisions that I made or that others made, or that were, you know, things that were the results of situational things. And I think that's just a testament to where, not necessarily where I'm at right now, but where, you know, how I feel about, you know, what led me to here, you know, and how I feel about, you know, what I have left in the tank to going forward. So that's a great question. That, you know, I think the fact that I paid attention and life, you know, happened in ways that gave me time to digest and understand that, you know, the mistakes that were made weren't really necessarily mistakes, because they were beneficial to the next experience, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's the really, you know, the biggest part of it, you know. You know, there were silly moments. You know, I spoke to Glenn Hughes when he was working on something, and he had approached me about being a part of this trio, and it sounded just like awesome, you know. And his whole, what he wanted was, he said, man, I want all of you to play. I want this trio, the way we see it, we want a drum, a bombastic, just no holds barred, you know, go all the time, the three-piece power trio. And it was so exciting talking about it, but when it came right down to it, you know, it was like I still had lessons to learn in life that had I went into that situation, I would have developed differently. It would have taken me longer to be a grown up. It would have, you know what I mean? It's like music to me is such a integral part of, you know, of me. You know, it's not what I do. It's you know, it's how I've learned. It's the mistakes I've made were within the context of the bands. You know, the lessons I've learned were within the context of the bands and the music and all that stuff. And it's always been that way. So, I feel like the relationships that I have with people and the, I guess, you know, the people who know me, you know, the way they treat me and you know, the trust in my character and, it's just those things are the reasons that, you know, I'm okay with every aspect of all the relationships, all the left turns when maybe I should have turned right, all that stuff, you know. And interestingly enough, you know, where I'm at musically now, it's just I've really enjoyed working with creative people on, you know, from all over the world, but on every level of their process, you know. I've worked with really young bands that by the time we were done, you know, working on their song, they learned something, you know. And then I found myself in positions where it's like working with mature, you know, people that know how it works, and they hired me because they knew what to expect out of what I would do, and they trust me to do it. You know, if somebody gives me $50 to play on a track, it's going to be 3 weeks of hell. If somebody gives me $5,000 to play on a track, it's going to be 30 minutes of good job, thanks. Because yeah. It's funny how it works, but you know, that's how it is. And I just, you know, I enjoy the opportunity to play music still as much now as I ever did. So it's just fantastic.
Dave, it's been an absolute pleasure for me to get a chance to connect with you and have this beautiful conversation. Now, for me, looking back at, you know, my development as a drummer and being influenced by a lot of the work that you have done, it's just really great opportunity for me to get a chance to let you know how much I appreciate and value your contribution.
Well, that, let me tell you, my friend, I didn't really know, you know, what success was, you know, when I started out. I knew, you know, I knew I didn't want to, I didn't want life to suck. but, you know, I wasn't naive enough. You know, I knew that there was no, that life was not an easy process, no matter what your achievements were or your bank account or your whatever. You know, we all have to go through our stuff. But when Natasha Schneider told me two sentences that made me realize that I indeed was a musician, that I could hold my head high and call myself a musician, and I could appreciate the people I looked up to and was inspired by as musicians, it allowed me to realize that, you know, like what you just said, that defines my life as a success, to inspire somebody else to feel something that motivates them to maybe sacrifice something to feel something for themselves. You know, it's like, to me, to have achieved that, and to, you know, to hear you say that, and when people tell me that, I inspired them in some way, it's like, that is always in my thoughts when I sit down to play music. It's always in, you know, I don't struggle to, you know, should I continue, or is it worth the pain, or is it this? No, it absolutely is, because, you know, you'll be listening. So it's fucking awesome. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Dave. It was an honor and a pleasure to connect with you today.
Well, we'll have to do it again.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to the Drummer's Pathway podcast. Please share and subscribe, get the word out, and let's keep the discussion going. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.